ups going up, and then to climb down the other side for 500 paces. If the slope turns back uphill by then, you keep hiking upward until you reach the next peak. But if you go downhill for 500 paces and the slope keeps going down, you turn around and hike up to the last highest point you found. As you can imagine with our fake mountain range, your perspective and heuristic can help you find a decent solution. But in this case, little did you know that there were other, better solutions out there. And this is where teamwork can help. Say you're working with someone who shares a similar perspective on the problem you're working on. He'll get dropped off at the same place on the mountain range as you originally did. But let's say that your teammate has a different mountain climbing heuristic than yours. His strategy is to hike until he reaches the trough between two mountains, and then to go up whichever one is steepest. Using this technique, he might continue past you and find that the next mountain over has a higher peak. In this case, it turns out that our teammate's diverse heuristic allowed him to find a better solution. He then calls down from his mountain peak at this point, and you join him. This is how group work often happens. Whoever in the group has the best heuristic will eventually find the best solution, and the group hopefully follows it. This is why we put people with different specialties together, such as pairing a design expert and a programming expert together to build a website. With this strategy, however, eventually your group will run into a problem. No matter how many people are in your crew, if you all start on the mountain from a similar perspective, the group will eventually get stuck together on one peak. But this is where something interesting can happen. When you introduce someone with a different perspective, it's like she is getting dropped off on a different part of the mountain range altogether. She sees it from a point of view that the rest of the group doesn't. So let's say this happens. One of your team members shows up with a very different perspective of your mountain range. Even if she has the same heuristics as you, say you went to mountain climbing school together, and explores the mountain using your 500 paces strategy, she might end up finding a better solution simply because she started in a different place. But even if she doesn't end up finding a better solution than the rest of the group, her vantage point offers the group an opportunity. The group can now play with different combinations of perspectives and heuristics to test if there are higher peaks to be found. In this case, the heuristic of hiking to the trough and going up the steep way, combined with the new perspective, reveals the highest peak in the range. Thus, the whole group is able to get to a solution that nobody would have found on his or her own, the ne plus ultra of the mountain range. This is the math, as it were, behind the concept of synergy. The combination of diverse mental toolkits, looking at the cake sideways and moving the milk glasses differently, leads to the potential for a group to do better than the sum of its parts. It explains how a whole squad of smart people who think the same is less likely to find a higher peak on the mountain than a group of people who think differently. And it's our first hint at why some police partnerships outwit more bad guys and how teams like the Russian Five can beat competitors with better individual statistics. Most great sports teams tend to rely on players having a diversity of skills in order to specialize in different positions. But as any expert or athlete will tell you, the difference between skilled athletes and world champions is not about who's bigger or stronger. Just as it is with cops, world-class performance often comes down to an athlete's mental game. The Red Army were great at hitting a hockey puck, but the way they thought together was different from other teams. Their style, their problem-solving, their mind-reading made a difference for the team. It's not hard to see how Coach Tarasov's ninja hockey style, combined with Coach Tikhonov's toughness, led a whole generation of players to play on a taller mountain peak than their peers. The mountain analogy we just walked through comes from an acclaimed professor named Dr. Scott Page, who teaches complex systems at the University of Michigan. His research findings from years of studying group dynamics are conclusive. Teams with diverse mental toolkits consistently outperform groups of, quote, the best and the brightest. Let's put this together. By now, we've seen that problem-solving smarts, not physical toughness, is key to a successful police squad. And problem-solving smarts are going to be a function of that squad's cognitive diversity, its diversity of perspectives and heuristics. Unlike some jobs, where we want to just climb the same one mountain over and over, say, an assembly line, solving and preventing crimes is almost always a new custom mountain problem. This is why adding women to law enforcement changes things. But it's also why it wouldn't be such a great idea if we suddenly made all cops and FBI agents women. If every law enforcement partnership looked like Charlie's Angels, we might indeed increase the negotiation skill of a lot of departments. But we'd also be shooting those departments in the foot. No men at all would mean increasing law enforcement's likelihood of getting stuck on suboptimal mountain peaks on the other side of the range. We need lots of perspectives if we want to give our officers the best chance at solving hard problems. And as someone who loses his keys a lot, I've learned that once in a while, a team needs a guy with a good heuristic for kicking down a door. At this point, our discussion begs a rather obvious but important question. Is gender the only kind of difference that leads to cognitive diversity in police work? The answer is absolutely not. And this brings us to an important subject to step back and discuss before continuing. As we've discovered, cognitive diversity is a key element of teams that exceed the sums of their parts. But the term diversity itself is a tricky one, and we need to talk about it for a moment. Diversity technically just means variety, but the word has become a euphemism, especially in America, for one thing, race. It's the term many people use to refer to race when they are too uncomfortable to come out and say it. And since race is still very much a hot-button topic, diversity has in turn become a word that makes a lot of people nervous. Reality is, diversity doesn't mean race, nor does it mean gender, the second most frequent thing people think of when they hear the word. Because it's such a charged term, though, I'm going to use the word difference in this book as a catch-all, whenever I generally mean two or more things that are not the same. Whenever I use the word diversity from here on, I'll try to pair it with an adjective for specificity, like demographic diversity, or diversity of shoe sizes. It's a good habit that I'd encourage you to pick up too, if you don't already do it. Okay, sorry, but it's getting harder to talk with Peanuts, my restless 15,000-pound bull elephant in the room, so I need to explain something. I'm a Caucasian American male who grew up with more opportunities than most other people in the world. I neither possess the understanding and authority to resolve matters of most kinds of discrimination, nor can I make sense of the horrific atrocities that scar my own nation's past. This book is no sop for centuries of injustice, and I can't personally relate to the suffering of people who have gone through things that I haven't. So I'm not going to pretend to. The good news is, the study of human collaboration is a scientific discipline, like any other, and we're going to explore it as such. Hopefully, some of the things we discuss in this book can help us attack problems of injustice together. A better we means both you and me, so thanks for being here, and thanks for trusting my intentions. Now that we've explored the power of cognitive diversity, things are about to get interesting. But we need to be cautious about one more thing before we proceed. Some people would be tempted to take our lesson in perspectives and heuristics and use it to jump over other types of differences, or even use it as an excuse to say that demographic diversity like race or gender doesn't matter. That's a bad idea. It's a temptation we need to resist, and here's why. The most accurate way to predict cognitive diversity would be to open up someone's head and poke around inside their neural makeup. But because we are not James Bond villains, we have to look for proxies for different thinking instead. We need to be able to make our best guess based on other clues. Our perspectives and heuristics come from our life's experiences. Our neural pathways form as we live through stuff. So the more we can identify differences in life experience, the more we can predict cognitive diversity. Some of those experiences are obvious to spot. We studied different subjects at different schools. We grew up in different kinds of towns. We had that crazy thing happen to us that one time. But we can go deeper than that. Our brains are shaped every day by all the micro experiences we have. And those are affected by the way we see the world and ourselves. And how we see the world and ourselves is affected deeply by how the world sees and treats us. So, when we have a group of people who look different, or identify themselves differently in some ways, we can guess that they may think differently in some ways too. In other words, if you and I are a different age or race or gender, it's highly likely that we have experienced life differently. People look at us differently. They speak to us differently. They invite us to do different things. They include us or exclude us at different times. And in some cases like height, age, or physical ability, we may literally see things differently. Sometimes those different experiences are subtle, and sometimes they're more blatant. But they slowly form a mosaic of mental wiring. That mosaic shapes our perspective and beliefs, how we define and predict things, and helps us develop our heuristics and skills, how we approach and deal with things. So it turns out that demographic differences end up being pretty good predictors of differences on the inside. Let's use another hypothetical scenario to illustrate how proxies for cognitive diversity work in practice. Pretend that it's the year 2010, and you're making a movie starring Tom Hanks. At the last minute before you start filming, Tom tells you he can't do the movie anymore. Whom do you replace him with? This is a question that Dr. Page likes to ask his University of Michigan students. But I'm a geek, so I decided to ask several thousand American adults whom they'd pick in this same scenario. I collected answers online and then sorted them by the responders' races. White people chose a wide variety of Hanks replacements. Josh Brolin, Harrison Ford, Hugh Grant, Brad Pitt, and my favorite, Ryan Gosling, were common. Robert Downey Jr. received a slight plurality of votes, and Tom Hanks' son, Colin, gathered a high percentage too. Black people, however, picked the same person 52% of the time. Denzel Washington. It turns out that race aside, Hanks and Washington are two of the most similar actors in Hollywood. They're about the same age and height. They have similar demeanors and are longtime family men. They're versatile performers and winners of the same kinds of awards. Each has done funny movies but is not a comedian. Each has done both blockbusters and Oscar bait. They even get paid about the same. In fact, Denzel Washington may just be the best fill-in for Tom Hanks in Hollywood. As with our cake puzzle, this is obvious once you see it, but it's easier to see it from the perspective of a black person than a white person. To be clear, being black doesn't mean you will pick Denzel. There's just a much higher chance that you will pick him than a white person will. Once again, what makes the difference is the way you think, which has to do with all the little things you've lived through. My friend Eric, who's Mexican-American, provides us with an excellent example of how our mental mosaic can be shaped by all sorts of experiences. I'm multilingual, he says, so even if you speak Mandarin, English, and Swahili, I can relate to you because I know what it is like to think in one language and dream in another. And despite their different races, Eric says in many ways he thinks more like director George Lucas than he thinks like many Latin Americans. He and Lucas both grew up in Modesto, California. So depending on the problem mountain range, adding Eric to a group of black and white Northern Californians might not increase cognitive diversity very much, even though he's Latino. But adding him to a group of locals in Mexico City might. Our life experiences add up to what legendary leadership transformation coach Keith Yamashita of SY Partners calls how we roll. Basically, this is our operating style, the day-to-day application of our unique mental mosaics. Yamashita says that great teams take time to understand as much as possible about how their members roll. How do they learn best? Do they do their best original work in the morning or the afternoon? How do they like to manage their time? What do they need in order to thrive? How do they argue? What are their biggest strengths, their superpowers? Then, anytime we face a challenge, Yamashita suggests stepping back and doing two things. First, take a moment to frame the problem. Is it a routine problem? Does it require breaking new ground? How high are the stakes? Routine problems don't require much, or often any, cognitive diversity, while novel problems benefit from it greatly. Based on that, Yamashita says, do a casting session. He uses the word casting deliberately. A movie director doesn't just grab whoever's around, or whoever was in the last movie she made. The cast for every movie needs to make sense for the plot and script. Understanding how we roll not only helps team members to appreciate each other's differences, but it also becomes a pragmatic way to figure out who might best contribute their mental toolkit. I might be a gay Asian dad, which is true, says Yamashita, but a more relevant difference in a particular situation might be, I'm a morning person, or I'm very empathetic. When we start to think about team building as casting, we start to think of our differences as gifts, rather than statistics and numbers. It's not a Noah's Ark mentality, Yamashita says. We don't need every kind of person in every meeting. The casting director's question is, what group of people will give us the best shot at a breakthrough? The most exciting part of this puzzle is not simply putting different kinds of people on the mountain range together, though. It's what happens to them next. Part 8. In 2013, professors from 4 U.S. universities got 186 Americans who identify themselves as Republicans and Democrats, two groups that tend to think differently about many things, to read a murder mystery. Each person was told to prepare to come debate the answer to the mystery with someone who disagreed with them. Half of the people were told that they would be debating with a member of the other political party. Half were told they would debate with someone from their own party. And then something interesting happened. It turned out that Republicans, who were told that a Democrat would be debating the case with them, prepared more clever arguments. And Democrats who went up against Republicans did too, even though the topic had nothing to do with politics. The study concluded that being put together to work on something with people with different viewpoints jolts us into cognitive action that we don't get when we work with people who we assume share our perspective. Quote, simply interacting with individuals who are different forces group members to prepare better, to anticipate alternative viewpoints, and to expect that reaching consensus will take effort, writes one of the study's authors, Dr. Catherine W. Phillips, vice dean at Columbia Business School. Quote, simply adding social diversity to a group makes people believe that differences of perspective might exist among them, and that belief makes people change their behavior. This is one reason why research studies from McKinsey and Company and Catalyst Group show that the more diverse thinkers in a company's higher ranks, especially its boardroom, the more likely it is to come up with strategies that turn higher profits and avoid making stupid mistakes like buying bad companies. It's also a reason why cities with more immigrants from different parts of the world tend to produce more patents. People think more critically when different people are around. If you've got a group of people planning how to remodel a building, and a person in a wheelchair rolls in to join the planning session, everyone is suddenly going to think a little bit differently about the project. Or when, say, a masculine group of law enforcement agents brings in women as collaborators, the men will suddenly begin to think more critically about the challenges at hand. And it turns out, vice versa. Here's a fun bit of research on police dyads that goes in the other direction than what we've been focusing on. A classic study published in the Journal of Policing and Safety shows us that female cops benefit from having male partners too. Women in mixed-gender police duos have more confidence in their work and recall details from suspect situations more accurately. Other factors that lead to fewer wrongful police shootings and bad business deals, according to various studies, include having a mix of age diversity in the room, having a mix of straight and openly gay team members, and having people who are both parents and not, each increases such groups' chances of better decisions. Part 9. When Kate Warren first walked into Alan Pinkerton's office in Chicago for an interview in 1856, Pinkerton assumed she was there for a secretary position. To his surprise, Warren, who was around 23 at the time, declared that she was responding to his newspaper advertisement for detectives. Widowed at a young age, Warren had learned how to fend for herself in the tough streets of Chicago. She knew she had unique skills the detective agency could use. But, Pinkerton exclaimed, it is not the custom to employ women detectives. Warren knew. What she lacked in brawn, she would make up in cleverness, she insisted. Women, she said, had an eye for detail, and were patient. Plus, Warren argued, she could be, quote, most useful in worming out secrets in many places which would be impossible for a male detective. Pinkerton thought about it that night. Despite the objections of his associates, he hired Warren the next day. He didn't regret it. Warren proved to be one of his most capable agents. "She has never let me down," Pinkerton later said. "And she changed the dynamic of the entire agency." We should take note that there were two areas of advantage that Warren's gender brought to detective work. The first was external. As a woman, she could walk under a bad guy's nose without suspicion, much like Chris Jung did at the mob wedding. But second, and more important, Warren brought a different way of thinking to Pinkerton's enterprise, just like Jung helped the FBI come up with cleverer plans because she thought differently. Warren's skill at disguises and logistical maneuvering was instrumental in saving Lincoln. And Warren changed the way Pinkerton thought about detective work and helped him build the most successful private detective agency in history, an agency that would lay the groundwork for the Federal Secret Service. Because of Warren, Pinkerton made his company logo an eye with the words, "We never sleep," underneath it, a nod to her having stayed up all night watching Lincoln. This trademark caught the public imagination and became the origin of the term private eye. Together, Warren, Webster, and Pinkerton formed a dream team. The agency, and those three in particular, went on to shape the private detective industry as it's known today. Warren's contribution to Pinkerton's firm was so valuable, one newspaper called her the best detective in America, maybe the world, that Pinkerton had her build a department he called the Female Detective Bureau, whose job was to supply women agents to collaborate on various male agents' cases. Pinkerton wanted a dream team working on every one of his cases. The women and men remained in segregated hierarchies within the agency, reflecting the backward social norms of the 19th century, but the mere inclusion of women in detective work was remarkably forward-thinking for Pinkerton's time. More important to Pinkerton, including female agents this way was brilliant for solving cases. He had been convinced of the power of cognitive diversity. Coincidentally, the most notable proponent of cognitive diversity at the time was, in fact, President Lincoln. How Lincoln convinced his biggest ideological rivals to work with him in the White House has been well chronicled in books and films. Lincoln knew that his team's different ways of thinking gave him the best shot at winning the Civil War and keeping the nation intact. If only more presidents after him had understood that. So far, we've seen how people can do extraordinary things together by combining cognitive diversity. You'll notice how each Dream Team member we've met so far brought a different toolkit to her or his respective collaboration. Warren and Webster contributed very different things to Pinkerton's Dream Team of detectives. Though they played like they could read each other's minds, our Soviet hockey players each brought very different things to the rink with them too. And it's not a stretch to say that the Red Army reigned because of the combination of their coaches' heuristics and perspectives, Tarasov's radical creativity, and Tikhonov's ferocity. There's still much more to piece together in our quest to understand dream teams, but as we've seen, without different mental toolkits, we limit how high up the mountain we can go. Notice how this runs counter to the advice that we tend to get in many of our organizations. "Get more people like that on the bus," we say. "Let's double down on our strengths," we proclaim. "Let's not hire her, she's not a culture fit," we advise. But unless you're recruiting an army of hammer swingers to break rocks on an assembly line, this kind of advice is profoundly stupid. What does fit get us but homogeneous thinking? What does collecting carbon copies of ourselves do but stick more people on the same mountain peak? Quote, "If you see your job and your work as primarily known things or small increments, cognitive diversity is not that important," says Yamashita. "But breaking new ground," he says, "by nature, requires different angles, different ideas, different ways of doing it, different backgrounds, different sensitivities, different layers, different slices." Indeed, breakthroughs happen when we break the mold. We've learned that when it comes to making progress together, the differences that matter most are the ones inside our heads. And those differences are built by our experiences, which in turn are shaped by who we are. Knowing this is good news for a couple of reasons. First, It gives us a concrete reason to collaborate with people who aren't like us. A utilitarian excuse to be inclusive, which also happens to be a good moral choice. It also helps us to know what kinds of things to look for when building teams to solve problems together. Different perspectives and heuristics, and the things that are proxy for them, experiences, identity, and biology. This gives us the foundation for the rest of our teamwork exploration. It also hints at the skill set we can develop as individuals if we want to get better at solving problems ourselves. The mountain analogy applies just as well within our own heads as among groups. People who can think through lots of perspectives and heuristics at once have higher chances of finding a solution to tough problems than others. As F. Scott Fitzgerald famously declared, "The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposing ideas in mind at the same time." Learning to do that, to train ourselves to become open-minded and find new perspectives, wouldn't just make us better collaborators, it would make us smarter ourselves. After all, says Dr. Page, we did not get the theory of relativity from a crowd. We got it from a diverse, novel thinker in a patent office. But before we get to all of that, and to the other crucial factors that make regular teams into dream teams, we have something pressing to sort out. If we're going to conclude that our differences and the cognitive diversity that flows from them makes us smarter together, then it turns out that we have a problem. Why do differences almost always make groups worse? Chapter 2. Trouble in Shaolin. Part 1. In May 1998, two massive worlds collided. Chrysler, the Detroit-based maker of Dodges and Jeeps, had the highest profit margins of any auto company in the world. Its product development cost was half of Ford's and one-third of General Motors, even though it was the smallest of the three companies. Despite this, CEO Bob Eaton worried that Chrysler wasn't prepared for the future. As the internet empowered people with more information, car buyers demanded higher quality. Advances in electronics threatened to make Chrysler's engine designs obsolete. And a surge of cheaper and superior Toyotas and Lexuses imperiled the jobs of Chrysler's 123,000 blue-collar workers. Daimler, meanwhile, was one of Europe's top manufacturing companies. The 300,000 employees of this German-based maker of Mercedes-Benz and Maybach built some of the nicest cars, trucks, and buses in the world. Though Daimler was on the cutting edge of automotive design, CEO Jürgen Schrimp was worried too. Daimler pumped millions into research and development, but was having trouble making a big return on its investments. The company had a tiny market share in the United States, and it too feared mounting competition from Japanese automakers. The two CEOs realized that their company's heuristics might cancel out each other's weaknesses. Chrysler's unbeatable efficiency plus Daimler's legendary innovation, killer combo. Daimler's quality and Chrysler's cowboy can-do would make them unstoppable. Combined, they'd have the tools and talent to take on Ford, GM, and Toyota, and to become one of, if not the, biggest automobile companies on the planet. So they made a deal. Eaton and Schrempf shook hands, and Daimler and Chrysler became Daimler-Chrysler. Schrempf called it a merger of equals, a merger of growth, and a merger of unprecedented strength. The new company was worth around $100 billion. It was the largest transcontinental merger in corporate history, and it would go down as one of corporate history's biggest disasters. According to the Harvard Business Review, between 70 and 90% of company mergers fail to achieve synergy. That is, they don't manage to eventually turn two companies into one business that's worth more than the sum of the individual company's value before the merger. More alarming, half of mergers actually result in a worse business. Few cases of this are as dramatic as Daimler-Chrysler. 3 years after the merger of unprecedented strength, the $100 billion company was worth somewhere between $44 and $48 billion, about what Daimler had been worth by itself. It was supposed to be the greatest merger ever, a dream team of automakers. What happened? The colossal failure has been the subject of many business school case studies. Some point to how the two companies overestimated their potential. Others illustrate how management stumbles hampered growth. But those things alone didn't wipe out $50 billion in value. Daimler Chrysler didn't crash because their cars got worse, or because its managers forgot how to do their jobs. The cause of Daimler Chrysler's epic tumble is the same thing that's doomed the majority of mergers in modern business history. The merger failed because of cultural conflict. On the surface, Daimler's and Chrysler's people were very similar. They were 400,000, mostly male, mostly white, engineers and designers and assembly line workers, and managers who loved cars. Quote, they look like us, they talk like us, they're focused on the same things, and their command of English is impeccable, said one Chrysler executive of his German counterparts, as reported in a Dartmouth case study. There was definitely no culture clash. This assessment was laughably superficial. The Germans and Americans who were now supposed to work together had different communication habits, different concepts of personal space, and different negotiation tactics. They had different core beliefs about women in the workplace and the role of leadership. They had different levels of intensity, different motivations, and different perspectives on what mattered when it came to making cars. In other words, they had, as we learned in the last chapter, significant diversity of perspectives and heuristics. The new company spent a few million dollars on cultural workshops like sexual harassment in the American workplace and German dining etiquette. But those were superficial too. From Daimler employees' perspective, the goal of automaking was uncompromising beauty and precision. Quality at all costs, they would say. But to Chrysler workers, the goal was utility and affordability for their customers. The Americans thought their new German co-workers were elitist. The Germans thought the Americans were risk-takers with bad taste. Some Daimler executives even told the press they would never drive a Chrysler. Though their complexions were similar, Daimler-Chrysler employees were as different as can be. Less than 10 years later, the two companies broke up. Schrempf left amid shareholder anger. Eaton had been long gone by then. A private equity firm paid a reported $6 billion, 10% of Chrysler's 1998 value, to spin the Americans out. Soon after, the company went bankrupt. Aside from the massive price tag attached, this is not a rare story in the business world. More than half of mergers lose value rather than maintain it. Half of those say that the most significant factor in the failure was organizational cultural differences. 33% say cultural integration issues. In other words, most mergers that lose money don't do so because of bad business. They lose money because their people can't deal with their differences. It doesn't take a whole merger for this to happen either. The same thing occurs when companies simply hire people from different demographic backgrounds and merge them into their workforces. At the time of this writing, 90% of Fortune 500 companies had hired a head diversity officer of some sort to help recruit and keep demographically diverse employees, because teams made of people of different races and genders and ages, they argue, would be smarter. Much like what I argued in the last chapter. But like mergers, hiring statistics show something disheartening. Adding people who are different to the team usually causes problems. The research is straightforward. Racial, cultural, and gender diversity tends to lead to increased conflict, conclude professors from four universities in a sweeping study for the Strategic Management Journal. Adds Dr. Nigel Bassett-Jones of Oxford Brookes University, quote, heterogeneous groups experience more conflict, higher turnover, less social integration, and more problems with communication. This puts organizations in a pickle. If they embrace demographic diversity, they risk workplace conflict, Dr. Bassett-Jones writes. And if they avoid diversity, they risk loss of competitiveness. Welcome to the paradox of differences. As we learned in our exploration of law enforcement and the parable of Problem Mountain, cognitive diversity makes us smarter. But unfortunately, all the studies show it also makes us more conflict-prone. And that conflict often blows our teams up before we can make use of our differences. A review of 700 U.S. companies by Harvard professors concluded that not only did most demographic diversity programs have no positive effect, but many made things worse for minorities. Research on government diversity hiring programs found no evidence that they, quote, created a more equitable work environment for women or people of color. Zero. And more disheartening, research from Portland State University found that assigning only minorities to run diversity management programs, quote, further marginalizes these already marginalized groups. It actually deepens the divisions. On a civic level, a study by the Harvard political scientist Robert Putnam shows us that the greater a town's or country's ethnic diversity, the fewer people voted or volunteered. As we mentioned in the last chapter, diverse cities tend to produce more inventions and patents. But Putnam's research showed that they also had lower social trust, meaning people were more nervous around their neighbors. And follow-on research shows that this social trust is a more powerful predictor of economic growth than levels of human capital or skills. But wait, didn't we spend the last chapter talking about how differences are what give us progress? Didn't we learn that companies with diverse leadership make more profits? Didn't we discover that police departments and intelligence agencies get better when they include women and other different kinds of people? Get ready to be depressed. Despite everything we learned in the last chapter, a study of 464 police departments across America found that the departments with the most racial diversity had the most officers who were fired or quit. Studies show the same is true of most businesses in general. Sure, differences lead to problem solving, but they also tend to lead to conflict among collaborators. Imagine for a moment that you're Chris Jung in the early 1970s. You're starting your first job after graduating from the FBI Academy. You show up to your office and find that you are the only woman. You're also the only agent of Asian descent. The male agents all get along extremely well. They go for beers together every other Friday. They talk in sports metaphors and have their own bro code. When you speak and act a little differently than the gang, some of them are annoyed. When you suggest a wine bar for Friday's drinks one week instead of the sports bar, they laugh at the idea. When you get ignored or interrupted in meetings, no one seems to notice but you. Perhaps you stand up for yourself and they get irritated. Worst of all, half of your colleagues don't even realize any of this is bothering you. There's a reason we use the term culture fit so much at work. It's because when we have it, we have peace. If you're the cultural outsider in a tight-knit team of coworkers, your unique ideas and perspectives are useful, but your presence causes some friction. If only you could be more like the rest of the gang. And that's the upshot with Daimler Chrysler. If the newly merged company's employees hadn't had so much cognitive diversity, there would have been less conflict. And with less conflict, that merger wouldn't have lost so much money. Or so they thought. Part 2. A few years before Daimler and Chrysler joined forces, another merger was taking shape in the government housing projects of New York City. A merger that would change the life of Robert Fitzgerald Diggs. Diggs had 10 siblings and grew up in 10 different projects. His last memory of his father was from when he was a toddler. It was of Dad smashing up furniture with a hammer right before he left Mom. Diggs' mother's meager wages kept the family in government-subsidized apartments. Queens, then Brooklyn, then Staten Island. In one basement-level room, Diggs and five brothers slept on two twin beds. Sometimes heavy rains would cause the sewer to back up and fill their window view. He was a thoughtful kid. He would later write about the silver lining of that miserable life. Quote, "Living where shit floats was a source of precious wisdom," he observed. Religion became his lifeline. First, Baptist Bible study. Then, Islam, with its lessons about mathematics and peace. Then, Taoism. 10-year-old Diggs decided he liked them all. But he got swept up in street business anyway. Selling drugs, running around with gangs. At one point, a teenager shot and killed one of Diggs' friends. In the 80s, neither Jesus nor Muhammad could keep kids in the projects out of the life. In his early 20s, Diggs moved to Cleveland. he immediately got caught in crossfire between rival gangs. One day, when he was driving his cousin's girlfriend home, he was ambushed by jealous gang members. They shot at the car, the girl, and Diggs. Diggs returned fire. The car took a beating. A person took a bullet, and Diggs went to trial. The city wanted 8 years for attempted murder because Diggs fired a pistol into the dark. A black kid from the New York projects didn't stand a chance against a motivated Cleveland prosecutor looking to make an example of what happens to gangbangers who move to his town. But Diggs went to the law library. He studied day and night to prepare a statement for when he took the stand. When his turn came, he delivered an impassioned speech. He told his story. The effect was so powerful that 3 of the 11 white jurors hugged Diggs after declaring him not guilty. The headline in the local newspaper read something like, "Jury cries as Diggs' sentence comes." It was a second chance. "I got 8 years of my life back in my own hands," he said. He stopped smoking and drinking until he could take control again. He quit hanging out with gangs. He moved back to New York. Growing up, Diggs had an eclectic assortment of hobbies. He could quote the plot of any kung fu film the local library had on order. And his second religion, after his homespun Christian Islamo-Taoism, was chess. He and the other kids in the projects played for thousands of hours. And like his peers, Diggs was entranced by a new type of music emerging from the Bronx in the late 70s and early 80s, hip-hop. He had started recording hip-hop beats on makeshift equipment at age 11. After the trial, Diggs began taking long, meditative walks. On those walks, he developed a vision. He would blend his favorite things, chess, kung fu, religion, and music, into one. "Meditation allowed me to connect them all, to see their possibilities," he later wrote. "I realized that nobody else could do that at the time, because nobody had that particular group of experiences." He would use them to start the greatest rap group ever. But it wouldn't be any rap group, he decided. It would be an empire, a rap army. And he would name it the Wu-Tang Clan, after his favorite kung fu movie, Shaolin and Wu-Tang. It was a ridiculous idea. Thus begins our second merger. Diggs recruited the best amateur rappers he knew from the Brooklyn and Staten Island projects. They ended up with 9 guys, including Diggs. A few of them he knew already, his cousins Gary and Russell, and his roommate Dennis. Most of the others were drug dealers, guys Diggs had met in the street business. Some were even from rival gangs. Diggs used their love of hip-hop, plus the carrot of getting out of the projects, to lure them together to hear his plan. It was simple enough. "Give me 5 years, and I will make you number one." Diggs would create the beats, and each rapper would write his own lyrics. Each would create his own kung fu persona, and Diggs would decide who got to record what. Each man would pitch in a few bucks, and Diggs would produce their first single. The 9 men agreed and pooled whatever cash they had. And so, in October 1992, Gary Grice, a.k.a. GZA, Russell Jones, Old Dirty Bastard, a.k.a. ODB, Clifford Smith, a.k.a. Method Man, Corey Woods, a.k.a. Raekwon the Chef, Dennis Coles, a.k.a. Ghostface Killa, Jason Hunter, a.k.a. Inspector Deck, Lamont Hawkins, a.k.a. U-God, Jamel Irieff, a.k.a. Master Killa, and Robert Fitzgerald Diggs, who from then on became known as the RZA, booked a recording studio. And then they nearly killed each other. Part 3. On the surface, the members of Diggs' hip-hop crew were as similar as the respective engineers and managers at Daimler and Chrysler. They were all young, black, alpha males who'd grown up in the projects of New York City. They all loved their hip-hop craft, and each of them was more or less down with kung fu. But that was about where the resemblances ended. Some of the guys were from the Stapleton projects, others from Park Hill. A couple weren't even from Staten Island. They were from rival projects in Brooklyn. They made a big deal about this. And egos aside, their personalities were far from similar. Some were calm, others violent. The oldest was 26, while the youngest was pushing 17. They loved hip-hop, but each of them had a different style of hip-hop. ODB was charismatic and rhythmically unpredictable. GZA and Massa Killa were cerebral and laid back. Method Man had grit-voiced braggadocio. Raekwon rapped fast and aggressively, while Inspecta Deck waxed intricate. Ghostface's style was more emotional, while U-God's was blaxploitative. Diggs thought these contrasts were cool, but nine cooks with different tastes was a recipe for food poisoning. Like Daimler and Chrysler employees suddenly working together, social trust in the Wu-Tang Clan was low. RZA and Method Man, perhaps the two most talented artists in the group, argued like crazy. But no two trusted one another less than Raekwon and Ghostface. Ray thought Ghost was a crook. They'd been enemies in the neighborhood for too long. "We didn't know each other enough to really trust each other," Raekwon told me later, referring to the group as a whole. "Differences is differences, you know?" As the nine young men gathered to work on hip-hop, they immediately got in each other's faces. Some of them carried guns with them when they went out, which meant their constant bickering could easily turn to violence. But Diggs managed to keep their guns in their pockets long enough to present part two of his plan. Quote, "It was almost like he did a Gotti move," Raekwon recalled years later. "He brought all the families to the table. And then he did something clever." "Being in the crew didn't mean your voice was going to be on the record," RZA announced. He was going to produce Wu-Tang's tracks the way hip-hop itself was born in the underground party scene. "Every session was going to be a battle of lyrics," RZA told them. "He'd make a beat, and they should come prepared to compete on the microphone. After all," he said, "hip-hop was a war." Part 4.
This all starts in Jamaica with DJ culture and sound system culture.
This is Andre Torres, the executive editor of Rap Genius. I was sitting with him in a converted warehouse in Gowanus, Brooklyn, trying to bone up on my hip-hop history. Having grown up on pop punk and country music in the middle of farm territory, I didn't even know how to pronounce RZA when I was first lining up interviews with Wu-Tang and other rappers.
He eventually made his way with Kool Herc to the Bronx because he was Jamaican. But they would have sound clashes, you know, one sound system DJ battling another. Even if you came with some dope records, most people wouldn't be able to hear them. You see what I'm saying?
Because were they playing at the same time?
Yeah.
Literally simultaneous as the other guys?
Yeah. I mean, to a point where you were going to drown the other guy out.
Sorry, I'm late.
No problem.
Came all the way from Staten Island.
This is Rob Markman, Rap Genius Artist Relations.
You're talking about how kind of hip-hop developed.
So I was getting into, like, the early tension and, you know, it started literally with the DJs and sound systems. It wasn't about the MC.
Master of ceremonies.
It was all about the DJ, and the MC was really in support.
They weren't even talking about how good they were. It was like how good my DJ is, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then when another DJ came on the set, his MC would talk about how good his DJ is, and then eventually started competitions and the MCs would take different shots at each other.
Right.
That's how it morphed. But it was really about to show how good my DJ is.
Turning point certainly was the Busy Bee, Kool Moe Dee battle at Harlem World.
Yeah, it was Harlem World.
In 1982. That's, you can hear part of it online. You know, but that was a break from, you know, what started out as, you know, throw your hands in the air, just throw, you know, the little short party couplets.
I listened to the clip. Busy Bee's hyping the crowd up by shouting things like, ba with the ba, yo bang, da bang, diggy, diggy, say ho, come on, y'all.
Busy Bee was kind of like the guy who everybody was, he was the top dude. Kool Moe Dee was on the come up with a group called Treacherous Three at the time, and he was like, looking at Busy B like, yo, this dude ain't all that. Like, I'm gonna come. And so he let the dude get up on stage and do his thing, and then he comes up and just destroys him with like 5 minutes of just like way beyond any just straight party. He was getting personal, he was talking about the dude.
And here's Kool Moe Dee. "Hold on, Busy B. I don't mean to be bold, but put that ba diddy ba bullshit on hold. We're going to get right down to the nitty grit, going to tell you a little something why you ain't shit.
Like, that was a break and a sort of new way of doing this MC thing, where it became more like, oh, I'm going to come up and I'm going to crush you and make you look like
people weirded out, where they're like, whoa.
They were loving it.
Yeah.
They were going crazy.
It was a crowd pleaser because it was like nothing you ever heard. And Busy B, at the time, Busy B is the man.
Oh, my God.
And he's part of the reason that you come to the party in the first place the same way. You know how they always say that most people watch a Floyd Mayweather fight to see him lose?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it wasn't that you came to see Busy B lose, but when he got taken out, it was just like, holy. Like, it was just a new twist on, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's when it started shifting.
Yeah.
The tapes, like you would tape the live performance and people would pass those around and treat those like records.
Eventually, when these recordings, when they do make it to record, it sort of sets the standard.
It seemed like that idea of the battle helped sharpen hip-hop itself.
Without a doubt.
You know, that was how they did it. And then on Method Man's first album, they had a song literally called Meth First Chef, where there was this RZA beat that everybody wanted, and Method Man wanted it, and Raekwon wanted it, so he made them battle for it.
Which, you know, I think, you know, forces creativity.
Part 5. In their efforts to win over partygoers, 1970s Bronx DJs and their hype men didn't only give birth to a new genre, they created a laboratory for musical innovation. Week after week, competing musicians would write new lyrics in preparation for the next battle. If you got beaten, then you couldn't wait till the next Friday to try again, hip-hop historian and author Jeff Chang told me. You came back to the party with something fresh. The musicians often found their advantage by hacking their sound equipment itself. There was no such thing as a fader switch to allow you to turn the volume down on a speaker while still listening to it in headphones. A DJ named Grandmaster Flash soldered such a switch onto his gear, allowing him to mix and match pieces of two different records back and forth like it was magic. This is a staple of any kind of DJ performance today, but at the time was groundbreaking. When electronic sound machines came out, DJs broke them open to add computer memory. This let them play samples or snippets from other songs, or even violin or drums by pressing keys. Battling pushed musicians to be more inventive and to combine diverse ideas into new sounds. Even though on the surface, the hip-hop battles were often competitions between individuals, the competitors became a sort of team that pushed the genre forward. Out of their battles sprang not just hip-hop, but R&B, techno, electronica, and whatever the hell dubstep is. Diggs paid for the studio time to record the Wu-Tang Clan's first single in quarters. There he channeled his rapper's diverse aggressions into the microphone. Each member dug deep and showed up to record as if for a real battle. Wu-Tang Clan truly did take a martial arts approach, Diggs later wrote, to the sound of the music, the style of the lyrics, the competitive wordplay of the rhyming, the mental preparations involved. They made a single called Protect Your Neck, with 8 rappers and 7 verses, and started selling it out of the trunk of a car. The sound wasn't just unique, it was epic. A few months went by, and then a DJ on a local New York radio station played the track. The Wu-Tang couldn't believe it. High off that momentum, they holed up in a basement on Morningstar Road to record a full-length album. Enter the Wu-Tang 36 Chambers. Diggs siphoned electricity from the neighbors to run his borrowed equipment, an 8-track, a sampler, and a keyboard. He cribbed drum beats from old soul albums and sound effects from the film Shaolin and Wu-Tang. Diggs didn't come out of the basement for months. His eyes grew sunken. His afro grew nappy, in his words. Ghostface shoplifted canned food from the local grocery to feed him. And finally, the RZA took off his headphones and played the record. 36 Chambers was a masterpiece. Their combined musicianship had created a sound no one on planet Earth had ever heard. It would take 3 years of playing underwhelming clubs and selling records out of trunks for the world to finally notice. But when it did, 36 Chambers went platinum. Wu-Tang Clan's second album would debut at number 1 on Billboard. Its members would go on to collectively sell 74 million records over the next 20 years. They would inspire a host of future Grammy winners, from Kanye West to Kendrick Lamar to white boys like Macklemore and Ryan Lewis. Critics from Rolling Stone to The Village Voice would eventually call them the greatest rap group of all time. Part 6. Our two stories present us with another paradox. Both in the case of Daimler Chrysler and in the case of the Wu-Tang Clan, teams which at first appeared similar were in fact hiding fundamental areas of difference. Cognitive diversity led these apparently homogeneous groups into big conflict. In one case, that conflict destroyed a company. In the other case, it changed music history. As we can see, it would be too hasty of us to repeat the myth that the conflict that arises from our differences is bad. But it would be equally hasty to generalize the opposite. Conflict in the hip-hop industry was often far from productive. Things got ugly in the rap scene. The first hip-hop pioneers were competing only for a crowd in a dance hall. But in the late 1990s, the war came to be centered on issues of money and turf. East Coast rappers developed beef with West Coast rappers, and vice versa. Instead of challenging each other musically, some artists started challenging each other with guns. Things came to a head when two rival rappers were assassinated in close succession. The big moment of truth was after Tupac was murdered and after Biggie was murdered, Chang, the hip-hop historian, explains. This massive evolution of style occurred because of the battle, but then the battle spilled into the streets. Conflict helped the industry innovate, but at what point does conflict become counterproductive, he asks. To get at the answer, we're going to go back in time. The year is 1901. It's a sunny summer day, and you're walking down 3rd Street in Dayton, Ohio. Two-story brick buildings line the road. Small storefronts, manufacturing shops, ice cream parlors. Birds are chirping, pedestrians are chatting. It's an idyllic Midwestern scene. As you stroll past the striped awning of a bicycle shop, you hear a jarring sound coming from inside, shouting. If you were to walk by the same bicycle shop again, you'd learn that the shouting went on every day. It commenced in the morning, paused around noon, and resumed after lunch. This nonstop ruckus was commonplace at the company's previous location on South William Street, and it carried on unabated at the company's next shop in North Carolina. But the fighting was not, as it might appear, a symptom of an abusive relationship. It was simply the way these two shopkeepers worked. When they needed to solve a problem, they would raise their voices and start arguing. But then, the shopkeepers would do something interesting. After a fair amount of debate, they would stop, switch sides of the argument, and start yelling again. The one who just debated against something would now argue for it, and vice versa. They'd do this until they worked out a solution to whatever they were stuck on. For most of us, schizophrenic yelling matches may sound like a hostile work environment, but most of us aren't Wilbur and Orville Wright, the inventors of human flight. As a kid, I discovered a great way to irritate my own brother, shooting him with a makeshift rubber band gun comprising my forefinger and thumb. In physics, there's a concept called potential energy that's illustrated well by this brotherly attack. A regular old rubber band lying on the table has very little potential energy. If you leave it alone, it's not going to do anything. But when you pull the rubber band from two directions and stretch it, suddenly it has a lot of potential energy. If you let go of it, it will go flying. And the more you stretch the rubber band, or put another way, the more tension you put on it, the more potential energy the rubber band has, the farther you can shoot it. Of course, at a certain point, if you stretch the rubber band too much, it will snap. All that potential energy breaks the rubber band, and now it's inert again. We might even chart the rubber band's potential energy. Now let's take a second and imagine a graph if we can. The chart has two axes. The vertical, y-axis, is potential energy, and the horizontal x-axis is the amount of tension. The relationship between potential energy and tension is basically a curve, like a skateboard ramp. It starts small on the left and grows in potential energy as the tension increases. But at a certain point, where the rubber band snaps, the potential energy drops sharply to zero. We can use rubber band physics as an analogy for potential energy in a relationship between a group of people. Whenever different ways of thinking collide, they create tension.